I believe it's one of the greatest pieces of personal, vulnerable writing that I have read. And it's all about what we're going through right now. And sometimes the best way to tell the truth is to read a story. Sometimes the best way to tell the truth is to tell it through a story. And this article appeared in the Tablet Mag, which I believe is a Jewish something or other. I don't know. And, oh, we got a winner. Ashley's our winner. She's on the phone. How are you, Ashley?
Hi, Kennedy.
Is this Ashley Duran?
This is Ashley Duran.
So we've been engaging on Twitter, and now I finally get to hear your sweet voice. How are you doing?
I'm good. Yes, yeah, it just occurred to me. This was a whole cast. I'm doing well. I just got home from picking up my son.
Wonderful. And so you might be hoping you're going to win the manly little Christmas then to give him.
Well, actually, I'm really trying to go for the merry one because my daughter has seen the doll and is just absolutely okay. In love with it. So yeah. I'm going for that one.
And can you attest? I mean, it's hard to find a gift package this good anywhere else.
Oh, of course not. Yeah, you can't find anything that even comes close to it.
Wonderful. Well, congratulations. And I know that you know Mike, so we won't talk about the insider trading about how you got the sixth caller on the air. Okay, we'll leave that for off the air.
Okay. Yeah, hush, hush.
All right. Thanks for calling and congratulations.
Of course. Thanks so much. God bless you and your family.
Thank you. Bye-bye. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're just changing the world one gift at a time. Okay, so I've been through this before. This is an article by Ann Bauer. It should win every award, this piece of writing. It is incredible. And your jaws are going to drop, I hope. In April 1939, as a result of a backdoor bribe, a 35-year-old lumber baron named Bruno Bettelheim was released from the Buchenwald concentration camp on the condition that he leave Germany and never return. In addition to running his family's sawmills, Bettelheim had earned a degree in art history and, like many Austrians of the time, dabbled in psychoanalysis and read a bit of Freud. His wife once cared for an emotionally disturbed child in their home. When he arrived as a refugee in the U.S., he used these random details to remake himself as an expert in human behavior. A small man with a striking Viennese accent and manner, he believed he had valuable psychological insights for the 11 months he spent inside. From the 11 months he spent inside Dachau and Buchenwald. Back in 38, when Bettelheim was imprisoned, these were primarily work camps where prisoners were divided, stripped of their possessions, then beaten and herded, like animals by the guards. Bettelheim noted that the men most damaged by alienation and violence, the one who gave up hope, had a similar effect. They avoided eye contact, rocked and muttered, and gazed at distant objects. He felt he had witnessed what it takes to break a person's mind. Bettelheim's first job in the United States was as a research assistant at the University of Chicago, studying high school art curricula. He divorced his wife, who had also emigrated, and taught briefly. In 1943, he published a paper titled Individual and Mass Behavior in Extreme Situations, claiming to have studied more than 1,500 concentration camp prisoners. Legendary general and future president Dwight D. Eisenhower praised his work. Overnight, Bettelheim became a quote-unquote doctor and a star. On the strength of the paper, his false claim to have worked with Sigmund Freud and his status as an intellectual and refugee from Hitler Germany, Bettelheim was made full professor of psychology and director of the Sonia Shankman Orthogenic School for Emotionally Disturbed Children at the University of Chicago in 1944. Once established at the school, he won a grant from the Ford Foundation to start a program specifically for autistic children. Parents from around the country sought his help for their children who were mute, withdrawn, unable to follow directions, prone to stimming, that's gazing at an object or blinking rapidly into light, self-harming, or failing to toilet train. In the mid-1950s, Bettelheim developed a new theory of autism, based on his 1943 paper and the passing remark of a researcher named Leo Kanner, who said autistic children, quote-unquote, never defrost. This was called the refrigerator mother. Bad parenting, like imprisonment in a Nazi work camp, was an extreme situation, Bettelheim said. He characterized the mothers of children in his program as cold, distant, abusive, and uncaring, like domestic SS guards. Though no studies were done to back up this hypothesis, his theory that rejecting mothers cause autism became the accepted science of the time. In his 1967 book, The Empty Fortress, Bettelheim wrote, "Infants, if totally deserted by humans before they have developed enough to shift for themselves, will die. And if their physical care is enough for survival, but they are deserted emotionally or are pushed beyond their capacity to cope, they will become autistic." Dr. Bettelheim enjoyed decades as a media darling, appearing on television. He was a regular on the Dick Cavett Show and serving as top expert for newspapers such as the New York Times and the Washington Post, which credited him with, quote-unquote, originating many of the techniques and principles of modern child psychiatry. Woody Allen gave the pop psychiatrist a cameo as himself in the film Zelig. Commonweal magazine published an article entitled "The Holy Work of Bruno Bettelheim." He wrote a series of world-famous best-selling books. The refrigerator mother theory of autism became gospel, not just among psychiatrists, but in the zeitgeist. It made sense and was easy to grasp. Better, it turned a mysterious and heartbreaking condition into a simple problem of who was to blame. People rallied behind the idea that cold mothers caused autism because it gave them comfort. Mothers whose children developed normally knew it was because they were good. Fathers and other relatives of autistic children were off the hook. Even desperate, quote-unquote, bad mothers embraced the idea, believing that if they could fix themselves, their children would be cured. Finally, an answer. They needed to sign up for intense psychotherapy and send their autistic children to live with other families or in residential programs. Some mothers were advised to rehome their healthy children as well, lest they, quote-unquote, refrigerator qualities leak over and spoil another young mind. Many complied. Occasionally, families would reject the diagnosis and their children would be taken by force. Reports were made, psychiatric teams mobilized. They showed up at the homes of autistic children, packed their bags, and removed them, while guards held off the screaming, protesting mothers who'd been deemed unsuitable. As a side note, does anyone wonder why I've embraced a very anti-modern state mentality? This shouldn't even be possible. Continuing, Bettelheim called this process parentectomy, a sad but necessary practice that would help autistic kids be cured. Many were taken to the orthogenic school he ran, where they stayed for up to a dozen years. It wasn't until 1990, after Bettelheim's death by suicide at 86, that residents and staff from the school began talking about his rages, name-calling, constant lying, and abuse. I would characterize the atmosphere at the orthogenic school at that time as the beginnings of a cult, with Dr. B as the cult leader, wrote a former counselor, W.B., in a letter to the Chicago Reader in July 1990. But by that point, almost 50 years of damage had been done, during which any clinician who came up with a different diagnosis or questioned Bettelheim's practices suffered immediate and devastating professional consequences. In the orthogenic school, psychiatrist Richard Kaufman told the Chicago Tribune, "Bettelheim's mind supplanted your own." I was 23 when Bruno Bettelheim, a man I'd never heard of, took his own life. The following year, 1991, my 3.5-year-old son, Andrew, lost language. One day he could talk, the next he was yodeling in a strange, high-pitched voice, flicking the lights on and off and staring for hours as he spun a single wheel on a toy car. My then husband and I were too young and too poor to have a child, much less two. Our one-year-old had respiratory problems and asthma, which consumed time and money. We were on the edge, barely able to pay our bills and buy macaroni and cheese. It was just dawning on me that I'd married a dreamy, quixotic guy who drank when he was troubled and couldn't hold down a job. That's what county social workers saw when they were called to assess Andrew, following his meltdown at our public library. A tiny house, a fraying marriage, two depleted parents in cheap clothes. It was winter, on the Iron Range, where advances in psychology took some time to travel. The experts, a stoic North Country man and woman team, decided we were the cause. They questioned us separately and casually brought up the idea of temporary foster care. We protested and were told we could keep the boys, but only if we submitted to frequent visits and attended parenting classes twice weekly, which we gladly did. While we were being taught how to impose consequences and establish routine, Andrew and his brother were taken to a child care room where teachers helped them sing, play, and socialize. At first, Andrew seemed to improve, brightening and even talking a bit. But then he regressed again, a pattern we'd seen repeat on loop for the rest of his life. When an older relative came to visit us in the spring, she took one look at my four-year-old sitting in the corner, staring at his hand. "You've ruined that beautiful child," she said, her face tense with fury. "You and your careless life ruined him. Aren't you ashamed?" We eventually moved to Minneapolis, where treatments were supposedly more advanced. At five, Andrew was diagnosed with autism and enrolled in a program that involved rocking boards, chewing toys, and roughing his skin with surgical brushes 3 times a day. We blamed ourselves for our son's problems, and most of the new theories did too. His autism was because we'd had vaccinated him, because we fed him wheat or dairy or corn, because we hadn't employed a team of workers to have constant floor time with him, the so-called sunrise cure, or applied behavioral techniques according to the Lavas method, beloved not only by late 90s autism parents, but also by conversion therapy folks. Each new wave was certain. The approaches to autism that had come before were barbaric and uninformed. But this most recent breakthrough was the one clear truth. Science had spoken over and over for a dozen years. We were heartbroken each time a treatment failed, and guilty because without fail, someone would insist we hadn't tried hard enough. Sure, we'd gone gluten-free, but had we cleansed him with hyperbaric oxygen? Behavioral training worked, but only if you did it 18 hours a day. Why hadn't we taken a second mortgage and flown to the Catskills for a workshop on the Sunrise Institute? Just shy of his 36th birthday, my then husband gave in and began drinking in earnest.